So basically, for the last few weeks, if you've been here, we've been studying, well, the life of the Buddha. We've been doing that since January, actually. We've had a long period of time exploring the life of the Buddha. Firstly, looking at sort of mythic dimensions of his life and its their relevance to us. And the last few weeks, looking at the sort of bringing in a bit more the social and historical context that the Buddha was teaching in. And we've been drawing inspiration for that from this book, Gotama Buddha, written by Vishrapani. It's a very interesting book that really gives you a richer flavour of life 2,500 years ago. So last week, Akasha Mitra gave a very evocative account of a king's meeting with the Buddha. And that was the theme of the Buddha in the world. It was about meeting this king. And he was a very troubled king. He was very troubled. He couldn't find peace anywhere. So beset with fear and anxiety. And that was because he had murdered his father. He had murdered his father so he could get the throne. And the story is all about, you know, what the teaching the Buddha gave him. So we sort of also heard last week that involved in the plot was of the killing was the Buddha's cousin, Devadatta. But we didn't hear too much about him last week, so I'm going to pick up the story of that this week. And our theme for this evening is conflict and crisis. So let's talk about this character, Devadatta, the Buddha's cousin. So yes, he was a Buddha's cousin. I don't know what the differences in ages were, but I sort of imagine that he was sort of following the Buddha before he became a Buddha. Siddhartha, his name was, before he became a Buddha. He was a prince, a wealthy young man. And I imagine Devadatta was aware of him, as you are with cousins. You sort of, you know, you know a bit about the family and you sort of might play with them, you might interact. I kind of imagine it was a bit like that with the Siddhartha and his cousin, Devadatta. Some stories talk about a little bit of rivalry between them, or particularly from Devadatta's side, sort of a bit of envy of Siddhartha even then. But really the story starts, and this episode that I want to tell you about really starts, well, as we know, the Siddhartha left home, he became enlightened. At some point he went back to his family, encountered his family again, and his wife, his son, his stepmother, they all went forth. They all also became practicing Buddhist. And so did Devadatta. So he followed many of the Siddhartha's family, the Buddha's families, into the homeless life. So we hear that he was at some point a sort of an accomplished practitioner, Devadatta, in that he had developed psychic abilities. And I get the sense of quite a charismatic man, really sort of quite confident and sure of himself. So this is Devadatta. And he's obviously seen how positive and successful the Buddha has been, really not just building a Sangha, but really beginning to transform sort of Indian society. So Buddhism really spread all over India, and it really made quite it was very dramatic, actually, difference to Indian society in lots of different ways. So Devadatta has been part of this. He's a monk. He's also practicing. He's seen the impact that the Buddha has had. And, I imagine that at some point he thought, I like what's happening. I like what the Buddha's doing. He's leading. He's really influential. He's, he's able to have kings and all kinds of people sort of coming to him. I imagine Devadatta said, I'd like a bit of that. I'd like some of that. So, we don't know how long that sort of thought began to sort of percolate. These things can start quite small, can't they? And then sort of grow as time sort of went on. But what we do know, and we're going to join the story when the Buddha, He's actually quite old at this point. He's in front of a very large gathering, hundreds of people, and there are kings. In fact, there's a King Bimbisara who was the king that was killed. So he's there, and there's many lay people there, many monks, many nuns, and it's a very vibrant scene, and the Buddha is there teaching. But he is old at this point. He is old. And we know this because Ananda, his attendant and friend, tells the Buddha this. He says, "It's strange," he says. "Your skin is no longer clear and radiant. Your limbs are flabby and wrinkled. Your body is stooped and all your senses are weaker." So we know that the Buddha is really getting old. And I think Ananda is like, this is weird, isn't it? Because you're aging like everybody else is aging. And actually, aging is a strange thing. Aging is a very strange thing because you think, oh, your body's changing and you don't have any control over it. So, you know, the Ananda's sort of reflecting on that. And then he's seeing, gosh, even the Buddha in his enlightened being is also subject to aging. How strange. So yes, the Buddha's getting old. And Devadatta, who's presumably younger than him, he's been biding his time all this time, and he can see that the Buddha is diminishing sort of physically. But he still has all the sort of mental and emotional strength, really. That hasn't diminished in any way. In fact, it probably, you know, I don't know how this works, but I imagine the Buddha was still had all the energy, all the warmth, all the love, strength, emotionally, spiritually, from the enlightenment experience. That doesn't diminish. So anyway, there's this large gathering, and the Buddha is there, hundreds of people. It's one of those very significant occasions, and Devadatta knows that this is the time for him to make his claim. So he steps forth in front of the whole gathering and says this: "Lord, you're really getting old. You're coming to the end of your life. You really now deserve just to rest and enjoy yourself. Let me lead the community. Hand it over to me." So the Buddha says, "Say not so, Devadatta, say not so." So Devadatta asks again. And for a second time, the Buddha says, "Ask me not that, Devadatta, ask me not that." And the tradition is, if you follow the sutras, the tradition is that if you ask the Buddha something once and he doesn't want to give an answer, then, you know, you ask him a second time, he doesn't want to give an answer, then the third time he's really going to give you an answer. So this is what happens. David is quite bold. He knows this, he knows what the tradition is as well, you know, he knows it the third time. He's pretty bold, and he continues in front of the crowd, and I imagine that the crowd are just holding their breath. You know, what is going to happen? I imagine there's anxiety, nervousness. I imagine there's some fear. I imagine there's astonishment about the whole thing. So what is the Buddha going to say? So he approaches him again and says, "You're old. Let me now lead the community." So there are different sources of what the Buddha says. So in one version, the Buddha says, "Enough, Devadatta. Do not aspire to govern the community. I would not hand on its leadership to Moggallana or Shariputra, let alone to you." So Moggallana and Shariputra are the chief disciples of the Buddha. They're really, really inspirational, really famed for their wisdom and everything, prowess. So that's one version, but there's a slightly tougher one, so I'll share that with you. So same thing: "Enough, Devadatta, do not aspire to govern the community. I would not hand on its leadership to Morgellana or Sharad Pritchard. How could I do so to a wretch like you? Who should be vomited out like a ball of spit. So, rather intense, I think. So you have to imagine the scene. So Devadatta, he's been bold. He's asserted his superiority, actually. That's what he's done. Due to the Buddha's age, he's assumed, well, I now bet, you know, that's what he's done, isn't it? Asserted his superiority due to, yeah, age and nothing else. He obviously believes in himself really strongly, but the Buddha in those words, I mean, you know, it cuts that down very effectively and very swiftly. So if you, well, let's not imagine us being Devadatta, but you can imagine how Devadatta must have felt at that point, because he's taken that opportunity in front of hundreds of people to assert himself, and he's got those words back. And in a way, I sort of see that, it's quite interesting, but and I see that as sort of the Buddha, well, it's like he's getting old, he's getting, you know, flabby and stooped, but the strength of communication, you know, well, it's like a lion's roar, it's like a lion roaring. So yeah, Devadatta is humiliated by that, and I imagine incensed by that. So he sets out on his plan B. I imagine he had a plan B. So plan A is to embarrass the Buddha somehow and to undermine the Buddha in front of, you know, his followers and supporters. But that clearly fails. So plan B is to kill the Buddha. I think that Buddha probably knew of Devadatta's intent all along. Because it sounds sort of harsh, doesn't it, what the Buddha said? I don't know if you experienced that. There's a few gasps in the room. So it's kind of, it sounds harsh, but I think the Buddha knew Devadatta's intent. And we have to sort of think that the Buddha is not serving his position. He's not sort of trying to think, well, this is my community, I'm leading. That's not what the motivation is at all. What the motivation is, well, the Buddha knows he's serving the Dharma. When the Buddha becomes enlightened, there's a scene where he thinks, well, who do I serve now? Who do I serve? And he realizes he needs to serve the Dharma. He needs to serve the truth so that the truth, you know, continues to help beings in the world. And in order for the truth to do that, you need practitioners, you need realized practitioners continue to pass that flame along, really. So really the Buddha is standing for the Dharma. He's standing for the truth in that occasion. And Devadatta, well, he's representing, if there were sort of symbolic sort of forces there, I think, well, Devadatta is representing, well, what do you think he's representing? What do you think he's representing? If the Buddha's standing for truth and compassion, what's Devadatta representing?
Ego and ambition.
Ego and ambition, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So it's not about the good of many. The Buddha's standing for the good of many. Devadatta's standing for himself, and for his ego, and for his own sense of power, basically. So yes, it's quite interesting to look at it as a symbolic sort of interaction, as opposed to just the characters. So anyway, plan B starts, and it's interesting that he goes to King Bimbisara's son, who we heard about last week, who's Ajatasattu. He goes to him, the prince. And I imagine he sort of whispers to him, you know what, you've got such good qualities, you know, you've got really great leadership skills. I think it's your time to shine. These old people hang on to positions longer than they need to. Take your rightful place. And maybe Ajazetu is like, well, how? Just kill your father. You don't know how long it's going to take, otherwise just kill him, get rid of him. So he tells him to kill his father and that he will kill the Buddha. And unfortunately, Ajazetu is successful at doing so. And Devadatta makes three attempts on the Buddha's life. So he first sends some bandits to kill the Buddha. And they have this really elaborate plan where they go in twos and then they go in threes and then they go in fours. But each time each sort of pair or threes approach the Buddha, they're overcome with the Buddha's warmth and love and or fearlessness. And they go for refuge. So Devadatta's furious with this, and he said, well, I can't rely on people to do this, so I will get an animal. So he releases an elephant, a wild rampaging elephant. I've never seen a wild rampaging elephant, but I can only imagine that it's, I can't even imagine it really. But just this force coming towards you. So the Buddha was out mindfully walking, and yes, this elephant is just released into his pathway. But the same thing happens, that the elephant is soothed by the aura of the Buddha's calm. So finally, Devadatta decides, well, okay, humans don't work, animals don't work, I'm going to have to do this myself. And the Buddha's walking underneath the vulture's peak, which is his rock. And Devadatta manages to release a very large rock, so it falls on the Buddha. And it misses. But there's a bit of the rock splinters off and pierces the Buddha's foot and draws blood. And in some accounts, you know, that's sort of noticeable after, for quite some time after. But it doesn't work. And the monks get really, really panicked by this. Somebody's trying to kill our teacher. So they have a guard, they try and set a guard around the Buddha to protect him. And then he tells them that you can't take the life of a Buddha. And he sort of dismisses them. So, but Devadatta doesn't give up his plans. The killing hasn't worked, so he goes back to plan A, which is really to get followers, to get some followers. And so what he does, he sets out five sort of new rules that he wants to put to the whole Sangha, to really obey. And these rules sort of state that anyone who wants to be a Buddhist and practice needs to really do it in the authentic manner, which is to live as a homeless wanderer, live in the wild, you know, forage for food, you know, in the way that the Buddha did at times, and many of his followers have done. But by that time, there's a really established sort of monastic community who have sort of settled dwellings, and there's many lay people as well. And then there are still some wandering monks as well, practitioners. But he says, this is the only true way to practice, and really we need to go back to the authentic manner. So these rules are put to the Buddha, and also in the meantime he accumulates lots of followers, Devadatta, who agrees or likes that way of practicing. So he has 500 followers who sort of accompany him. And these rules are then put to the Buddha, who rejects them out hand. And he encourages his followers, he encourages all practitioners, yes, to practice intensively in whatever lifestyle they have adopted. And then some accounts Devadatta's influence after that fails, partly because Shariputra, one of the Buddha's disciples. He hangs out with the 500 followers, he's a very impressive, inspiring teacher, starts teaching, and they can see the true way, and they gradually fall away from Devadatta's influence. And Devadatta's really furious, devastated, and one or two accounts just describe him as sort of just becoming more and more bitter and sad, lonely, and then sort of fading out, really. A more dramatic account, which is probably in keeping with the villain, is that he hears of these 500 monks defecting and leaving him. He vomits blood and dies on the spot. So you can choose whichever version you want. So, yeah, it's a very salutary tale there, really. But his plans fail, clearly. And as a result, we have the Dharma that we have today. So, something to think about. So, anyway, there were lots of other crises and conflicts in the Buddha's day. I came across one just last week, actually, which I was like, I hadn't heard that one before. So it's basically where some monks were falsely accused of raping and murdering a young woman. And in fact, the young woman had been murdered by a community, another spiritual community. They were growing more and more jealous of the Buddha's influence, and, you know, his teachings and what people said about him, and they just wanted to completely discredit the community and the Buddha. So they actually killed this woman and buried her body in the sort of grounds where the monks, you know, would be. And then they discovered the body and made a big sort of thing of it. And, you know, obviously the villagers were horrified, up in arms, and the monks were under intense, criticism, fear of attack, really, from the villagers. So they go and see the Buddha, really frightened and scared. And the Buddha tells them to control their fears, as they have nothing to be frightened about, as they are innocent of the accusations. So firstly, you know, I thought that's just very positive, isn't it? If you've been falsely accused of something, and you know you're innocent of it, then what your first thing to do is to manage your fear. So he tells them to be calm and to tell the truth from that place of calmness, and encourage others to also tell the truth. And then he says, when harsh words are spoken to a bhikkhu, to a monk, let him endure with an unruffled mind. So that sort of harsh words will be spoken, and endure. That's sort of forbearance, isn't it? It's on some level of, you know, I have just to be with this. With an unruffled mind is an unreactive mind. Knowing that you're innocent of what's, you know, you've been accused of. And apparently the lay people were very impressed with the monk's demeanour. Around what was a lot of chaos, and they were impressed with their honesty as well. And eventually the accusations died down and then stopped, and then more effort was made in actually discovering who the real culprits were, and they were discovered. So that's another crisis there. And the Buddha intervened in other, so sometimes there were other social and political crises going on around the community as well. So there was a point where there's a real crisis about the use of water in a river. Two opposing sides were about to go to war, and the Buddha intervened and was able to stop that war. So there were lots of incidences like that. And at times he wasn't able to have the influence that he wanted. You know, he would try to intervene in a situation and war would still happen. In fact, his clan that he originated from, the Shakyan clan, were apparently wiped out at one point through war. So, yes, so conflict and crisis in the Buddha's day. What can we learn from it? So, yes, we've had all types of incidents. There was one we heard about, Dibhadra spoke about a few weeks ago, a very famous one called the quarrel at Kasambi. Just to refresh your minds on that, two monks get into a dispute, a really minor domestic dispute, this one. It's the equivalent of, you know, arguing about the top of a toothpaste or the sort of mostly empty milk bottle that's still in the fridge. It was that kind of argument, really quite trivial. They develop views about the right way of behaving, and they start arguing about the monastic code. And then factions start, people start taking sides, and really, really escalates to quite a pitch. So the Buddha, hears about this and he goes to see them and to help restore order. He speaks to them. He's not really interested at all in, you know, who's right about how they should have done this domestic thing. That's not his concern. His concern is how they are treating each other. He's trying to speak to them and they just say to him, look, it's got really nothing to do with you. Leave us to it. We'll you go off and meditate. I really like this story because the Buddha does exactly that. He goes off and he meditates in the forest and leaves them to it. It's quite interesting because the quarrel does eventually end. And he ends by, it's the lay people, because the lay people are supporting the monks. It's them that's giving them food and other supports. And the lay people stop giving them food. So it's them that holds the key to this. It's quite interesting, isn't it? It sort of doesn't always come where you expect change to come. So yes, the lay people stop giving them food. And then suddenly they realise, oh, well, actually, this is not going to work for us to keep arguing in this way. The lay people really are looking to them for inspiration. They're looking to them to they're devoting themselves full time to practice so that they can benefit the world. So the lay people really need them to follow the practice and to practice ethics so they can also benefit. So if they're not doing it, why would they be supporting them? That's the logic there. They come to their senses, and then at that point they seek the Buddha's counsel. So there's quite a few, the Buddha talks quite a lot about conflict actually in different sort of sutras. But in this one he says, there's six roots of conflict in the Sangha. So there's conflict outside the Sangha, you know, social, political conflicts, family conflicts, and then there's conflicts within the spiritual community, the Sangha. So he says there's six roots of conflicts in the Sangha. So if a practitioner is angry or resentful towards the Buddha, Dharma or Sangha, or the teacher, Dharma or Sangha, if a practitioner or bhikkhu is disrespectful, insolent or contemptuous, envious or avaricious, deceitful or fraudulent. Those are the six roots of conflict in the Sangha. And I'll read you actually what he says. He says, here, Ananda, these six roots of disputes. What six? Here, Ananda, a bhikkhu is angry and resentful. Such a bhikkhu dwells disrespectful and undeferential towards a teacher, towards a Dharma, and towards a Sangha. And he does not fulfill the training. A bhikkhu who dwells disrespectful and undeferential towards a teacher, towards a Dharma, towards a Sangha, and who does not fulfill the training, creates a dispute in the Sangha, which would be for the harm and happiness of many, for the loss, harm, and suffering of gods and humans. Now, if you see any such root of dispute, either in yourselves or externally, you should strive to abandon that same evil root of dispute. And if you do not see any such root or dispute, either in yourselves or externally, you should practice in such a way that that same evil root of dispute does not erupt in the future. So it's pretty clear, isn't it? And then he goes through all the other things, like if you're angry, if you're, you know, fraudulent and that kind of thing. So I was quite interested in that. When I looked at it, I thought, oh, that's quite interesting, because in a way he really values the Sangha's role, the spiritual community's role, to sort of transform themselves, but it's also about alleviating suffering. He says, for the good of many, for gods and humans. So I was thinking, if you're embroiled in a dispute as a practitioner, if you're trying to transform yourself and you're embroiled in a conflict, a dispute, and you're not fulfilling the training, which means, I also take that to mean that you're not actually seriously trying to resolve that conflict. Yeah, you're not really trying to resolve it in the way that the monks, the Kosambi monks, were not trying to resolve it at the beginning. So if you're not trying to do that, it undermines your whole practice. It undermines your whole sort of motivation and intent, because your energies are split, aren't they? There's part of you that wants to be good and positive and, you know, kind and all the rest of it, and then the other part of you is very invested in maintaining, you know, this conflict. And invested and committed to doing so. And I think that just subtly, gradually undermines all the other efforts, all your other efforts to be positive and compassionate and warm. It just gets subtly undermined if you're holding on to a conflict. So acting with loving kindness, metta, is crucial. And it's not really about being nice. I think we can think, oh, it's about being nice to other people. It's not really, I don't really see it like that. It's nice to be nice, but really it's really about alleviating suffering. That's what metta helps us to do. It helps us alleviate our own suffering and the suffering we might also be causing in the world. It's helping us transform that, but also by transforming our own sort of hatred, craving, hatred and ignorance, we're also, by the fact of doing that transformation, we're showing that it's possible. Yeah, we're showing that's possible. You only have to have sort of someone to go away on retreat for, you know, a week or whatever, and they come back and people will comment on the changes that person, you know, I had somebody saying that to me this evening, that, you know, somebody closed them saying, you've really changed. And it shows, just doing that shows a possibility to others, yeah? Doing that work that we're doing. Shows a possibility, there's another way to live and another way that our consciousness can be. And that is very powerful. You don't know what effect that's gonna have, actually. Because we can think we're just doing it for ourselves, but actually, it's having an influence in the world. You had a question?
Yeah, yeah, no, I just, because you're talking a lot about some very good things, but I'm kind of missing the point of what the Buddha said about resolving disputes when with anger and resentfulness.
So what he said there, I'll just repack that. He said we have craving, hatred and ignorance within us, yes? That's what keeps us suffering. That's what maintains our suffering. We all have that. So practicing metta is one of the ways we can gradually transform those. Yeah.
But going back to the you gave us a comment about it does not fulfill training.
The training, yeah.
And that whole thing, they said it. My brain's not relaxed enough to absorb and
okay.
Translate what you said. You said, oh, that sounds pretty obvious.
Oh, you thought, oh, it's not obvious to me.
I don't really
okay.
Understand.
All right, don't worry. I'm unpacking it now, actually. Oh. So basically, that is really what that was about. Was the Buddha was saying it's about fulfilling the training, yes, and you know, resolving disputes, basically, and why that's important to do so. And I'm saying that actually we are often committed and invested in maintaining and keeping on a conflict. And if we are that, and you just have to look at your experience. I don't think I'm talking just about myself. if you look at your experience, when there's a conflict arisen, and we'll talk a bit, I'll go into that, why that is, a conflict has arisen, one of the first things that happens is that I'm right. I'm right. They're wrong. I'm good. They're bad. Yeah. Very kind of simple kind of ways that we see it, and therefore we're not thinking, okay, I need to transform this experience. I need to resolve the conflict. Usually we will resolve the conflict as we saw in the case of the monks, we'll resolve the conflicts when the pain of the conflict gets too much. Yeah? If the pain gets too much, or we just notice that we're suffering, then we begin to open up to the possibility of, I need to do something about this. Yeah? Does that all resonate with you? So fulfilling the training is the acts of resolving that conflict and committing oneself to that. And the training is the precepts, the practices, the ethics, the practices that we have. The metta bhavana is a very good starting point, essential starting point for that. So metta, we need that. In fact, if you look around the world, it's literally pick up a newspaper, put the TV on, look at social media, and conflict is everywhere. And you can see hatred, you can see ignorance, you can see craving at large in the world. So the Buddha really values the importance of the spiritual community as a place, as people who are trying to do something different, who are consciously trying to transform that suffering. We're not just accepting that's how it is, because we also have seeds of Buddhahood within us, the potential for freedom, for love within us. So we're cultivating that as best as we can. So the other thing about metta is it helps us resolve that sense of being separate from another person, because we can continue a conflict because we feel like completely separate, yes? And as soon as you start stepping into another's shoes, you begin to empathize a bit more, and you begin to see actually you may have things in common, yes, with that person or situation. And then again, that helps us have that motivation to resolve a conflict. So I had a very, I had experience yesterday of feeling very connected. So metta helps us realize our connectedness to the point where we feel another person's pain as our own pain, and feel another person's joy as our own joy. Yes. So yesterday I was driving to my mum's, and she lives in near the docks. And I was reflecting as I was driving. She lives at the end of a cul-de-sac, and there's a little high street. And I was reflecting, all the shops were shut, apart from one. And I was reflecting how drab the area looked, how sort of quiet and sleepy and just really drab, really. I was reflecting at that. It's very grey. Anyway, I sort of went to hers, and my sister was there, and she was getting ready to leave. So she left, and about 5-10 minutes later, I got a phone call from my sister. So she couldn't get out of the road onto the high street because it was all cornered off. And she said that she thinks there's been an incident there. And I said, well, I've just come from there. I didn't notice anything. It was just sort of, as I said, very sleepy, nothing happening. She said, well, there's something, there's all police there now. And then we found out that there had been an incident, somebody had been murdered in the one shop that was open. And it had such an impact, actually. I mean, suddenly the street, people were out in the street. It's quite a close community, really. So suddenly everybody was out on the streets. People that were trying to get out had to find out alternative routes out of that area. And I just thought, well, I've no idea who the person is. And it's immaterial, really, who it is. I know that suffering has this intense amount of suffering that's just been created here. And it's impacting on us now. It's one of those things that, it just stays with one, actually. It just stays with one. So I felt that those people's pain, and I knew that that was also going to have ramifications far and wide, that incident. And I felt that as if I had known that person. Really, it really did have an impact on all of us. So yes, conflict and crisis. As I said earlier, conflict is inevitable. Even in a spiritual community, conflict is inevitable because we're still trying to transform. We have greed, hatred, and ignorance, and we're still trying to transform that. So it's inevitable. But we're inspired by the fact that we can change, and we've been shown the way to do that. And we have tools to help us, such as ethics and meditation practices. So there's another sutra where the god says, a god called Sakka says to the Buddha, "I don't get it. I don't get it. Everyone says they want to be happy. Everyone says they want to be happy. And yet there's so much conflict. Why is that?" And the Buddha says, well, we have our likes and we have our dislikes. So that's true, isn't it? We have our likes and we have our dislikes. And that sounds fairly, well, yes, of course. But we're very committed and invested in our likes and dislikes. Yeah, and we think it's who we are. So I like this type of music. I vote for this party. I like this type of person. I don't like that type of person. And it goes on, and we define ourselves based on that a lot of the time. So when that's threatened in some way, then, you know, problems begin. So, but Sakka, the god, isn't quite satisfied by that. He goes, okay, likes and dislikes. What causes likes and dislikes? So the Buddha says craving or desire. So we either want something or we don't want something. But either way, a lot of emotion is there. So then Sakka says, okay, what causes desire? So the Buddha says, thinking arises from the tendency to proliferation. So I'll say that again. Thinking arises from the tendency to proliferation. So let's unpack that a little bit. So mental proliferation is another word, short word for that is papancha. And that's what happens when our thinking sometimes feels like it's got a life of its own. Yes, have you had that experience where you might have had it when you sat to meditate today. A sort of like our thinking just has a life of its own. And when it's papancha, it's fueled by negative emotion. Fear, anger, anxiety, righteousness. There's a spinning out of control. We can get very overwhelmed with our thoughts when they're like that. And we lose perspective. And we're kind of just focused on our thinking, then our sort of narrative. You know, we've just got one train of thought and we're very focused on that. And we're usually focused on what we want. Yeah, there's something that we want or we don't want. So papancha fuels conflicts. That sort of mental proliferation will fuel conflicts. And it can lead to crisis as well. So any questions around papancha, any questions generally, before I go on? Yes.
I'm trying to deal with that situation in a way that is sort of harmonious with the practice as far as I can.
Mm.
You know, I've used a lot of methods about this particular situation and trying to sort of empathise with the person on the other side. How can you distinguish between that situation where the other person's motivations are perhaps not entirely good?
Mm-hmm.
Should I use word, but yeah. not entirely, that might be fueled by ambition and ego.
Yeah, okay. So how would you deal with somebody else's mate? So you're doing your best. You're trying to resolve the conflict. You're trying to have metta for the other person. They may not be trying to do that, and their motives may be very mixed.
Yeah.
So what do you do around that? So any responses to that in the room before I come in? Go on, Martin.
Slap them.
Oh. Any helpful responses in the room?
Yes. On the Wednesday cast, we were doing a Dhammapada, and she did that bit, but I didn't know the whole story.
Right.
So that's really resonated with me. I guess it's the simplicity of warmth, trying, but it's very difficult to put in practice, isn't it?
Yeah, it is difficult to put in practice, but I think that's a good example in a way, because it's kind of like we can't control somebody else's behaviour. We can speak truthfully. I mean, in the story with the monks who were falsely accused, the Buddha said, tell the truth, encourage others to tell the truth. We can't control somebody else's behaviour, though. We can only work on our side of it. But we can tell the truth kindly, helpfully, as we see it, if we think it's going to have a positive effect. Yes? But you have to just keep working on our side of things. And we can't sort of make somebody change their motivation. Yeah. So trying to because I think that sort of causes frustration, doesn't it? Well, I'm trying, but actually we're doing what we need to do. And it's interesting that sometimes that has an effect, but not necessarily directly. Okay, question. Yes.
Well, that's true, but I think what was sort of interesting really was the strength of the Buddha's response to that when pressed, and that is, in a sense, allowable if that's a truth.
So that was the Buddha's response from the perspective of an enlightened mind.
Okay.
Being enlightened, there wouldn't have been, he was able to, I'm imagining and assuming, that he would have been able to see that what the understand and see Devadatta's intent in a way that we might not be able to with somebody else. Plus, our motives are mixed.
Yes.
Yeah, our motives are mixed. So it's really important that we do our side of it and not be able to make assumptions about somebody else. However, telling the truth is important as well. If we can be helpful and harmonious in doing so. So the monks were encouraged to tell the truth about their experience. And I'll come on to that in a bit about the speaking up side of things, yeah? Okay, yes.
This is fascinating, your question, and it relates to the Buddha's talking to
Devadatta.
Because my question is going to be similar to that, but more from the point of view of, in the Sangha, you've got something you will resolve, but the other person doesn't want to talk about it.
Yes.
And if you push too much, it depends on your intention. If your intention is to push to try and break through, that's one thing. If you know for certain that person doesn't want to talk, rather than just maybe what they say, then you are taking and not giving. And so anything to do if somebody is being mean to you or acting unskillfully, is to realise that anything you put on top of it is making it worse.
Yeah.
And actually is a fabrication, because you're putting something on top of it which you don't know to be true, because you don't actually understand. The ideal thing to understand that person may be suffering, may be acting from past experiences, what they're going through now, and what their external situation is. So is anything other than being compassionate to that person in that time, doesn't matter what they're doing to you, is going to make things worse. And the only way to find out really what's going on and to be helpful, and it also stops you from being helpful. People who are behaving badly, presuming they're being badly, because unless you meditate in the moment, you might be the one being badly, you don't realise. But the only way to actually to make progress in any situation is to have a non-aggressive response.
Yes.
So
yes.
You can see, and that enables you to see what's going on.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
But then, when the Buddha to Attila, the only reason I can say that he would be saying something like that, if it's that aggressive, is only if it's going to help
yes.
not just the community, but Attila. Because otherwise, I don't think...
You mean that everybody, the whole situation, including the person, David Attah, yeah.
He would not say that to David Attah unless he thought that with righteous indignation, without slapping someone down, there are other things he could have said to reduce his power just by being compassionate and seeing everybody.
Possibly. I mean, it's interesting that, I sort of read that thinking, God, that's a slightly controversial, isn't it, the way the Buddha responds to David Attah, because it is very strong. And you think, oh, actually, if I said that, I'd just be acting out of hatred and ignorance, in a way. But we have to see it in the light of what the Buddha's trying to do, which is to preserve the Dharma. There's a challenge, a direct challenge, and there's a direct challenge to not to just the Buddha, it's to the whole situation.
You can't preserve the Dharma
No, I don't think he's attacking him. I think he's actually saying what he sees as a truth at that moment about David Dasa's intent. And yes. I think that's what he's doing. But it's still strong. So just it's still strong, and I wouldn't recommend us do anything like that. I really wouldn't recommend us do anything like that, because for us, we need to be working on transforming our ignorance, hatred, and developing metta, and with that, clarity and wisdom. Okay, so I'm going to come on to a bit of that, because it's really quite key to how we actually then think about how to resolve conflict and crisis. We could really spend a whole day workshop on all of this, actually. So I'm going to just keep going, because I think some of it will come out as well. So papancha. Mental proliferation fueled by negative emotion, where we think, what our thinking is fact, if you like. Our thinking is how things are, and that is directing our actions, our behaviour. We lose perspective when papancha's going on. We lose a sense of connection to others, and we're not able to listen or reflect deeply. So do you all recognise papancha in your experience in some way? Yeah, it's good. And then, so we've got conflict. We talked quite a bit about conflict and the different ways conflict emerges. And then crisis, how I look at a crisis, these are my definitions of a crisis. So unexpected events, so these are sort of components of a crisis, basically. So it's a critical point of intense difficulty or danger. That's a crisis, a critical point of intense difficulty or danger where important decisions may have to be taken. So usually I think of it as there's lots of unexpected events in a crisis. There might be potential threat to an existing way of being or doing things. Very complex, so crisis is a very complex, lots of different factors are playing out. There's an urgency in the situation that something needs to happen. And depending on the scale of the crisis, there's other people invested in the outcome as well. As things are moving quickly in a crisis, then you need to, you need to establish facts, because rumours are very easily started in a crisis. Because people want to know, and people make assumptions, share those assumptions, share their interpretations, as fact, and they actually are rumours, and then that can actually add to a crisis. So the impact of a crisis, if you think about crisis, it can happen on a personal level, family level, work level, as we know. The impact of a crisis is overwhelming emotionally, can be confusing and disorientating, and our usual ways of responding don't seem to work. That's when you know you're in a crisis, yeah? And it's threatening. There's a real threat there to our existing way of being. So there's sort of two ways we can react to a crisis. We can want to protect and defend a situation that we hold dear, or we think has served us or been important. We sort of protect or defend that. Or we might be on the attack, wanting to get rid of a situation. Or we might be, is another way, we could be just overwhelmed and in denial as well. So these are three ways we can react to crises. And all of these are based on the wanting something to be a certain way or not wanting it to be a certain way. Yes? Back to the Buddha's cause of conflict. Wanting something to be a certain way or not wanting something to be a certain way. Craving. So, yes, so I'm going to say five things to think about how to deal with a conflict. And these are not definitive by any, you know, as I said, we could probably do a whole day on this. But let's just pick out a few things from the stories and, reflections. So the first is, and we heard about this, about being calm in the situation. So your emotions are going to be impacting on you in a crisis, yeah? And when our emotions are impacting on negative emotions, it's actually very difficult to know how to act well. In fact, I said to my hairdresser, I was patting my hair, I said, what do you do in a crisis? And she went, I'm just trying to be calm. Just try to be calm, because if I'm anything else, it's all going to go wrong. So I thought, yeah, that's what we do. And that's what the Buddha advised the monks to do, to be calm when they were falsely accused and people were after them. Number one, be calm. And we have our methods of doing this as well in meditation. So secondly, be mindful of papancha. So it can be very deceptive, papancha, because it can lure us into thinking that we understand the situation. But really what's going on is a train of thought is happening, being fueled by our fear. Yes? And our perspective is narrowed by that. So look out and be mindful of papancha and what's happening. And with papancha, really, we want to know who's right, who's wrong, who's bad, who's good. Usually it's those. Usually it's kind of it swings, yes, from this to that to this to that. And with papancha as well, we can't see clearly our role in a situation. We can see what the other's doing. We can't really see ourselves very clearly when papancha's going on. So we try and notice it, meditation, notice the nature of your thoughts, begin to understand what the emotion driving that papancha is. And what we want to do is begin to get to know the difference between papancha and reflection. So they're quite different things. So third, practice metta. So that's metta is really interesting, I think, because when we practice metta, what we're doing, we're allowing something to open within us. We're allowing some space to sort of come in, because papancha is getting us very tight, very fixed, very concretizing everything, and metta helps us just to begin to relax, open up, create some space. And it's in this space that we begin to look a bit more deeply at our experience. We begin to ask ourselves some more fundamental questions. We begin to listen to ourselves more and begin to recognise what we may be bringing to a situation. Even if it's just our interpretations. So what is true? So a very good question is, what is really true here? We have our interpretations and we believe that, but actually asking ourselves when we have some openness and space, what is true, what do we really know, produces often a different answer. And then through metta, keeping on practicing metta, there can emerge a desire to act, not just for one's own benefit, but for others in the situation. You begin to see that you're suffering, but somebody else is suffering as well. Other people are suffering. The desire to act a bit beyond one's own interest. And I think we saw an amazing example of that when Nelson Mandela came out of prison, because he had lots of time for reflection. One of the reasons I think that transition was successful was because he really cared not just about his own interests and, you know, his party's interests, his tribe's interests, you know, the African, black African's interests. He really genuinely began to care about other people, showed that he cared about other people's interests as well. And that shone through and then that enabled a dialogue. So metta, keeping on practicing metta, begins to open us up to others and what they may need or how they see the situation and their suffering in it. Fourthly, understand conditionality. So I haven't got time to go into conditionality. There's lots of talks on it. But basically, conditionality is things arise in dependence on conditions. Begin to see all the factors that have created that crisis. Usually we just see our own perspective, but there are lots of factors at play. And if we understand that more deeply, again, we approach the situation with a bit more clarity. And when we're approaching a situation with more clarity, we can then do our final action, which is to take wise action. So a crisis unchecked, or conflict, let's say, conflicts unchecked can lead to a crisis. And then crises can lead to tragedies. So I reckon that incident that happened yesterday, there were lots of conflicts there, lots of conditions, I think, that probably created that incident of that murder. There was a crisis before that happened, probably as I was driving along the road, that crisis was happening. It was unchecked. It became a tragedy. So we do need to respond often in a crisis. That's an extreme example, but we've got our own versions of crisis. So understanding the conditions that help bring about the crisis. And then we have metta as well. And then what is the ethical, most helpful thing to do in this situation? So asking ourselves, what's the ethical, helpful thing to do in this situation? For the benefit of oneself and others. So we may need to speak up and out. We may need to set boundaries. We may need to open up challenging conversations. We may need to confess. We may need to acknowledge our part in a situation. These are all the very different things that can happen when you've done that sort of reflection. But the main thing is that if we come in from that place of a desire for our well-being and others' well-being, that's our motivation, that's our base motivation. We're thinking about ethics, our ethics. How can we take action that's going to promote better understanding, better clarity? We know there's lots of factors at play in a crisis, so we can't control the outcome. But back to your question. We can't control the outcome, but what we can do is take the next step. We take the next step that we feel has come from reflection and come from a deeper understanding of the situation. And we obviously get support to do that. So the Buddha, as we heard, couldn't control the monks at Kasambi. He went, he intervened. He had to allow for other factors, other conditions to influence that situation. But it did. He acted, obviously, ethically, wisely by leaving them so they would really, at that point, just experience things for themselves. And so they were receptive to then actually ask for teachings from him. So we can't control the outcome. We can't control other people in this. But we can act ethically. We can act with metta. We can think about the benefits of ourselves and the wider situation. And we can look more deeply into conditionality. And allow papancha to fall away. Okay, we've run out of time. Maybe we'll do another session on it another time, but thank you very much. Thank you.